Hello, and welcome to the Musicuentos Black Box Podcast. My name is Sarah Elizabeth Cottrell, and I am the blogger behind Musicuentos.com. Welcome to the Musicuentos Black Box Podcast, a podcast designed to help you put second language acquisition research to work in the world language classroom. The topic of this episode is an article called On the Importance of Circumlocution in the Spanish Language Classroom. It was written by Deborah Arteaga of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and Lucia Llorente of Berry College, and published in the 2012 issue, number 26, of the journal Estudios de Lingüística Universidad de Alicante. This week I'm visiting my parents who have a treehouse on their ranch. My little girl and I climbed up in the treehouse and I was asking her to look at something with the telescope in the window. I generally speak to her in Spanish, but I realized I didn't know the word for telescope. So what did I do? Well, I did what a lazy bilingual mom does. I used the English word. A couple of days later, I was talking to a Mexican-American friend there about someone I knew who was pregnant and had been so sick she needed a PICC line. This friend does speak English very well, but I like to practice my Spanish with her and she likes to let me, so I was telling the story in Spanish. But I didn't know how to say PICC line. So what did I do? I did give her the English, but I thought she wouldn't know what a PICC line was even in English because I hadn't known it before my friend got one. So what else could I do? Well, explain it, of course. Especially since I was still annoyed at myself for not knowing what telescope was and not looking it up later. I told her a PICC line is a tube that's inserted under the skin so you can put medicine in the vein instead of taking it by mouth. What I resorted to there is a technique people use to negotiate meaning, that is, to try to understand something they don't understand, and is called circumlocution. Circumlocution is the topic of the article we're looking at in this episode. This article is a little different from the usual research article in a couple of ways. First, it's not a study. Rather, it's a survey of other people's studies and recommendations, and then based on that information, Arteaga and Llorente make their own recommendations. Second, it's language specific to Spanish. But the comments they make about circumlocution apply to any language you're teaching, and I'll do my best here to clarify and broaden the comments they make that are specific to Spanish. Also, sometimes in order to say something new, you have to be unnecessarily specific. Throughout this article, Arteaga and Llorente are addressing the breakdown in communication that happens specifically when students encounter words that vary from Spanish dialect to Spanish dialect. They see a problem in Spanish classrooms, particularly propagated by textbooks, and it's that especially as we're teaching vocabulary, we're not teaching dialectal variation. We're not discussing in class the ways the language varies from country to country. Instead, we're teaching a textbook variety that's artificial. It doesn't actually exist in any given place, and often it's a mishmash of several different varieties of the language. What does this have to do with circumlocution? The process of logic here is that vocabulary can vary greatly from place to place, and this can cause a breakdown in communication, and circumlocution can be an effective technique to solve that problem. So the author's proposal is threefold. One, help students acquire into their active vocabulary words that are commonly understood in different places. But also, number two, tell students that words do vary from dialect to dialect. And then three, help them learn how to use circumlocution to understand words in dialectal variations, especially the dialects that are most prominent where they live. I'm going to hurry a bit through the first two points because the last one, teaching circumlocution, is what I really want to talk about because it includes information and techniques helpful for any type of confusion arising from students not knowing any word in whatever language they're learning. First, teaching words that are common across dialects and teaching students words that vary from place to place are both challenging with textbook vocabulary lists, because first-year college textbooks don't usually acknowledge that words vary, and the authors are college professors. Instead, they seem to take one or two routes. They offer a list of word variations without describing where or how often they're used, or they randomly choose words from different regions, so your students might be learning the Mexican word for waiter and the Castilian word for salad dressing. Also, textbooks don't normally even acknowledge the difference between passive and active vocabulary. Passive vocabulary includes the words that you can understand but cannot actually produce, whereas active vocabulary includes the words that you can use when you need to. Their point here is to help students know that vocabulary varies and help them navigate the problems this causes by being able to use the most widely used words in their active vocabulary and to understand the other versions they may hear or have them in their passive vocabulary. One major problem in actually putting this into practice is that it's hard for teachers to know which words are neutral and which aren't. Words for clothing, for example, or foods vary widely from country to country. One answer is to just pick a Mexican word, since they represent the majority of Spanish speakers in the United States where I teach. But what about all the rest? I ran into a problem with this recently as I work on writing an elementary homeschool curriculum for Calico Spanish. In the second level, two of the communication goals are talking about family and reacting with the opinion phrase, "That's cool." I wanted to use "qué padre" because that's my first pick as a widely used Mexican phrase, but I didn't want to confuse kids who were learning that padre refers to father. So instead, I picked "qué chévere," a phrase that I picked up in South America. When the script went to the editor, he didn't like chévere because he thought too many people wouldn't understand it. It's not something he would have used. He suggested I switch to "qué bueno," which would be understood anywhere, but that lost so much of the expressiveness of "cool." So I wasn't willing to go there either. In the end, I chose the word "super" because I thought it retained the expressiveness and would also be widely understood. There's even a song about this on YouTube called "Qué difícil es hablar el español," or "Oh, how hard it is to speak Spanish." You can find it both ways. In the videos, two guitar strumming guys lament how they tried to learn Spanish as they traveled from Mexico to Patagonia to Spain, but never quite got it because every word you learn has another definition. So if you're going to learn Spanish, just don't move around. Anyway, back to the article. Arteaga and Llorente add that in addition to the problem of which word to choose, another difficulty is that most teachers aren't trained in linguistics and feel prescriptive about vocabulary. That means there's usually a word they like that they think is the right one. But all of this comes down to two basic conclusions for these authors anyway. Students need to acquire as close as they can come to a neutral vocabulary, and they need a strategy for when they come across the variations they don't understand. This also illustrates an important point. You can develop a fairly high proficiency in a language and still encounter vocabulary that causes communication to break down because it's from a region you're not familiar with. This happens to me all the time, and I'm betting it happens to you too. There are a few strategies that people naturally use when this problem arises. One is the strategy of using a word in the second language but confusing the meaning of it. An example in Spanish is using the word atender for attend, something my students do a lot. There's also something called coinage when you make up a word. Little kids do this all the time in their first language. Instead of "take the top off," my daughter says "untop it," probably because she's coining an English word based on the Spanish word destapar. Another strategy is Spanishifying it, like using the word queque for cake. Or you could just insert the English word, which is known as code switching. This is what I did with the example of telescope. All of these strategies that involve the first language, adaptations and code switching, are only useful when talking to bilinguals. But the goal is to be comprehensible to natives. When my students start a sentence with pozo, the word for a well you draw water from, I know what they're trying to do because I know the multiple English meanings for well. But a monolingual Spanish speaker would be super confused. Because of this confusion, and particularly that which arises from speakers using different words in different regions, Arteaga and Llorente call for students to learn a strategy that will help them navigate a situation when communication breaks down because of unfamiliar vocabulary. They also make a good point that communication problems happen much more frequently with vocabulary. If it's a grammar error, the non-native speaker is much more likely to be understood. When a non-native English speaker says, "Yesterday I go to the store," you recognize the verb error in using "go" instead of "went," but a native English speaker will rarely even address the error because the non-native speaker was understood. With vocabulary error, however, you want to ask a question to figure out what the thing is, such as, "What is a pick line?" The negotiation you engage in to fix the breakdown in communication is known as circumlocution. In the theoretical literature, circumlocution is often defined as a paraphrase or describing something because you don't know the word. These authors define it as when you can explain in the second language a word or phrase you don't know or can't remember. As a proficiency skill, circumlocution is spelled out in all the advanced levels on the ACFL proficiency guidelines. For example, the guidelines say that an advanced high speaker confidently uses communicative strategies such as circumlocution. In contrast, an intermediate mid-speaker, when asked to do an advanced level task, can provide some information, but it's difficult for them to use communicative strategies such as circumlocution to accomplish the task. Circumlocution is not mentioned below intermediate mid, because students at these levels do not use effective communication strategies. So the question is, if students below intermediate mid can't use circumlocution, can they be taught it? And a bigger question, if what leads to language acquisition is input and not output, should lower level students even be pushed to use output strategies like circumlocution? Earlier this year, I engaged in some rather interesting discussions with teachers who ascribe to the method known as Teaching Proficiency Through Reading and Storytelling, or TPRS. Those conversations led to a series of blog posts on the things I love, which are many, and the things I hate about TPRS. I also hosted a rebuttal guest post by my friend Carol Gobb. One of the fundamental disagreements I was having was on the role of output in the classroom. So, of course, it piqued my interest to see the input versus output debate show up in this article as well. In the research, circumlocution is regarded as one of the tools that are part of negotiation of meaning, the term for what happens when communication has broken down and the people involved are trying to remedy the problem. Negotiation of meaning requires two-way communication, that is, the people involved have to input and output. They have to speak and listen and sometimes watch. For Stephen Krashen, though, comprehensible input is the only way people acquire language. Others, like Swain, say that output is as important as Krashen says input is. Here, these authors argue together with others that communication strategies for producing language and for understanding it are both important. By extension, students need to be able to understand and produce circumlocution. Citing more research, the authors turn to the big names that always come up in discussions of output. Ellis has found that when students actively negotiate meaning, they understand words better than those who don't. And in a different study, he supports his claim that negotiation of meaning actually aids acquisition. That's a very important distinction because Krashen and many of his adherents would say that output never aids in acquisition. They would focus completely on providing students with comprehensible input. But for Susan Gass, students faced with input they can't understand can use negotiation strategies to make it comprehended input. According to one study, it would seem that given the tools, students can use negotiation of meaning strategies, such as circumlocution, to make their own comprehensible input, and that's the link. Their output can negotiate input to a level that aids in acquisition. Swain claims that students are better able to produce language if they have to negotiate meaning, or, as Gass puts it, make incomprehensible input comprehended. Think about that. Incomprehensible input can be as good or better a teacher as comprehensible input, because the process students have to go through to negotiate the meaning, using circumlocution, for example, helps them improve their speaking ability, or their output. In my view, you'll have to be careful here about the frustration factor. This isn't a blank check to flood novices with incomprehensible input and waste all the valuable time you have with them trying to help them navigate it. There's a balance to be found in how much work students have to do to negotiate meaning before they become too frustrated to make this process beneficial. But if you had followed the discussion I've been having with several teachers or even with Krashen himself for the last few months, you'd understand why I'm so excited to be making this connection to view output as a tool for acquisition when it negotiates input to a comprehensible level. But I digress a bit. The researchers have made their point, circumlocution is effective, and it's important to teach it. So the authors turn to this question. Can or should circumlocution be taught in the classroom? To summarize, studies show that circumlocution is helpful, but students don't do it. They switch to English for words they don't know. I do this with my own children when I'm just too lazy, like they did the other day with Telescope. What I should do is look it up. What I should teach students is how to explain it. And you should teach circumlocution, especially since textbooks don't teach it, particularly for lower levels. But how? The article ends with several great tips for teaching circumlocution. This is one of my favorite kinds of research, the kind that gives you some tangible things that you can turn around and do next week in your class. I'm going to try to describe the activities that the authors mention here. First, there's an idea from Willems. You explain paraphrasing and then give students pictures of unknown words they have to describe to a partner. Or you use crossword puzzles half filled in, and each student has to explain to a partner what the words are instead of, say, giving a translation of the word. Here's another one from Tyrone and Yule. The student has to explain target language words without using any form of the word. Classmates guess what the word is in writing, and the winner is the student best understood by classmates. Several others recommend that you start teaching your novice students key verbs like make, do, and have, subject pronouns, the uses of relative clauses, such as in the description, a child who does not have parents. Following their lead, you'd do this instead of long vocabulary lists because these lists do not help students develop skills in circumlocution. Elsewhere, Barry Bravo suggests similarly that we'd start teaching circumlocution from the beginning by teaching words like thing, person, and place, and then how to use them. You can probably see how this works. A farmer is a person who works on a farm. A farm is a place where animals like cows and chickens live. A cow is an animal that says moo. I've long advocated this approach to comprehensible input as a better alternative to the method of simply giving the word in English. Sure, if you stop with, a farm is where animals live, what if students think it's the word for zoo? But if you keep explaining and give students strategies to communicate to you whether they've understood, not only are you giving more comprehensible input leading to better language acquisition, but you're also helping students learn to circumlocute, a key skill they're going to need. In my class, we've developed this as a habit. When I ask in Spanish, what is an X? Most students' first reaction is to explain it in the target language rather than give me the English. They know I don't want the translation, not unless I say en inglés. This is a strategy advocated by Malecki, cited in this article a little later, as the teacher modeling circumlocution. I'm intrigued enough by Malecki that his article will probably show up on a future episode of this podcast. Those are the recommendations Arteaga and Llorente cite from other authors. What about their own? Here's where we come to the crux of their article, the specific strategies that these authors advocate for teaching circumlocution. First, teach the neutral term for something. It's not always possible, but when it is, it will be a tool to help them communicate better. Second, teach circumlocution from the beginning in college-level courses, and I'd say in all beginning courses, because we don't have the time to just let it develop. Start by teaching students simple ways to circumlocute vocabulary. The authors give many examples of how to do that, like, it's a person who, or it's the opposite of. They also include, it's a synonym of, which I suggest you amend to, it's the same as, or it's similar to, because it means the same thing, and those phrases are very useful in a great many more contexts than the word synonym is. The key is that you're producing a grammatical structure of definitions that are simple, not dictionary definitions. I do this with my vocabulary list in level 4. I define all their words in the target language, but often the dictionary definition is far too complicated, so I'll write my own, like an animal that lives in the woods, or an animal like Bambi for deer. Arteaga and Llorente also offer some sample activities by level. In one, partners describe regional terms to help each other match them with their region. The activity reminds me of the one mentioned earlier to describe the object without using a form of it, much like the game Taboo, which my friend Amy Leonard had her students playing recently to practice circumlocution. If you choose common objects whose words vary from place to place, like pen or sandals, you can start practicing circumlocution very early because these terms are usually introduced near the beginning of a course. This is the author's novice-level activity. Students practice using the circumlocution models they've been taught at the beginning. For an intermediate example, the authors use clothing terms in Argentina. Clothing and other categories like food are common in course units, and they also have vocabulary that varies widely. Students this time practice circumlocution with paraphrases and definitions and use the picture instead of the common term. And the reason is so that when they understand what the thing is, they can produce the neutral word. So it's supposed to be another step beyond the novice activity suggested. The author suggests using this activity when the textbook covers the geographical area used for the variations. Advanced students, on the other hand, would receive a dialogue with the words that are regionally specific italicized. They also receive cards containing circumlocuted information about the variants. Students come up with the common term and then offer more variations from other dialects. That's a brief summary of the techniques these authors suggest, and you can view the full list of their suggested phrases and more in-depth descriptions of their activities by accessing the full article online via the Black Box podcast page for this episode. The part of this article that hit me like a ton of bricks is so important I have to go over it again. The general consensus is that comprehensible input is the only way that people acquire language. But that doesn't mean that, as some teachers would advocate, your sole responsibility is to provide students with comprehensible input. Why? Because their world is filled with incomprehensible input. This means that we are responsible to give our students the tools they need to take that incomprehensible input and negotiate it to a level that's comprehended. In this way, once your students aren't with you anymore, they can still constantly be acquiring more language by providing themselves with comprehensible input. The major tool that they'll need to accomplish that is circumlocution, so we need to teach it, and we need to teach it early. By the way, if you're wondering, the preferred word in Spanish for telescope is telescopio. That was really hard. And a PIC line is catéter central de inserción periférica. Of course, I bet some circumlocution would have been necessary there anyway. For more episodes of The Black Box, resources, the Musicuentos blog, and information about services, visit musicuentos.com. You'll find my somewhat controversial TPRS posts mentioned in this episode there as well. For more information about the elementary homeschool curriculum mentioned in this episode, visit calicospanish.com. Join in the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/musicuentos or on Twitter at twitter.com/blackboxpodcast. Join me next time for more of the Miss Clinton's Black Box Podcast. It's the best of grad school without the tuition or the homework.